Hi and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast where I get to sit down and talk with some very interesting writers and lovers of film all across the world, all about the movies that help them fall in love with film. And this week is a quite special episode because it's officially the first year anniversary of the show being born, or in this sense, in the podcast sense, because I was doing this for a while on and off as an actual transcribed interview session with people before I started the podcast. But last year, March, I sat down for the very first time and recorded it with the complete intention of having it as a new podcast released to individuals and to enjoy. And I sat down with Mr. Andrew Parker, and I was just sitting down and questioning what I wanted to do for this 1 year anniversary, and I felt it was about time that I do what I've been avoiding doing, which is turning the focus on myself. And I felt very weird about it to start with, because I thought when I started this show that my biggest intention was to open up dialogue between me and other individuals to find out more about other people and their loves of film, as opposed to just continually doing what I do every day on my website, writing for myself or talking with my co-hosts in my other podcast, the Unnamed Movie Podcast, which is talking for myself, talking about my love of film. But at the same time, within the last 2 months of preparing episodes and trying to court guests to come onto the show, I have seen a pattern of people actually asking me, like, what would be my movie if it was to be the other way around? And I guess that means that there's an interest there for someone to talk to me about my own. And I, when daunted, should daunted be a word? It probably isn't. When I realized that I was going to do this, I had to ask myself whether I'd be dumb enough or vain enough to just kind of make it a half an hour of me talking directly into the microphone, and realizing that was a dumb idea. So I invited on one of my favorite guests of the show. He did it last year, and just like, we talk all the while on Twitter. We met in Toronto. He's probably one of the more cordial podcasters out there, especially when it comes to his own show, and a show where he ends up doing a lot of question asking of his own guests. I felt he would do a good fit to sit down and do the interviewing as opposed to being the interviewee on this podcast. So I have to take a moment to thank Ryan McNeil from over at thematinee.ca for stepping in for me for this episode. And as I even say later in this episode, I have no clue what I'm going to do next year when the second anniversary rolls around. Part of my brain says it'd be kind of cool if I keep having some form of a conversation with Ryan every year and seeing what happens with it. But I don't know what that would really turn out like, so we're going to have to see how it comes. I haven't even mentioned it yet. The film we're going to be talking about is the 1992 Quentin Tarantino directorial debut, Reservoir Dogs. I won't spoil much of the conversation, but it gets very interesting, and I feel like Ryan has schooled me proper. He has shown me all the ways in which I've been doing this podcast wrong, and some of the ways I've probably been doing it right. Ryan, what do you think? But anyways, I'm gonna let us go straight into the show. So thank you so much for listening. Go and give Ryan a message. Go tell him, hey, say, go listen to his podcast over at The Matinee. His podcast is actually The Matinee. Go listen to it. It's really good. I love it. But otherwise, here, enjoy the conversation.
Crime is a dark business.
Five-man job, busted in and busted out of a diamond wholesalers.
This heist.
Hey, Joe, I'm going to shoot this guy.
You shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize.
Is much more colorful.
Hey, your name. Mr. White. Mr. Blonde. Mr. Orange. Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
I pick. Be thankful you're not Mr. Yellow.
But you can't get the green.
What happens if the manager won't give you the diamonds?
Cut off one of his fingers, the little one. After that, I'll take
for the purposes of this conversation, you will be Mr. Green.
Why do I get green?
There's green in your flag. I am Mr. Red.
Okay.
Okay. And I'm a little bit out of sorts because this is my first time hosting somebody else's show.
Well, aren't you happy that you're so good at what you do that I feel comfortable asking you to do this?
Okay, well, we could go with that. No, I've been a guest on plenty of shows, but I've never actually hosted. I kind of feel like when Joan Rivers used to host The Tonight Show for Johnny Carson, this must have been what she felt like, because you got to hit the notes. Like I'm not doing my show, and I'm not guesting. So this is a first for me. So if I sound like I'm fumbling, that's why. But of course, I've listened to every episode, I believe. I think I might have stopped one or two of them early. I've listened to every episode of this show. And unlike your usual rhythm, I am going to start at the beginning, because I've noticed that you kind of get going and then you get back to the beginning. So let's start at the beginning. Mr. Green, I want to know a question that I don't think you've answered on any podcast to my knowledge. How did you get into film in the first place?
Oh, wow. It's a thing which just kind of happened. I mean, my family, I guess I even had that on, not really specific, but my family, my father is a big film buff. I had him on my show to talk to about a film specifically. But we were always a family of going to the movies here and there. We used to go into the drive-in a lot. We would sit down and watch movies together at home. My father loves to tell the story of how I, as a child, of being like 1 or 2 years old, and my older brother at that point being 4 or 5, he would sit us down and introduce us to the world of Freddy Krueger and just enjoy watching us writhing pain as we have showers of blood coming on the screen. I think I've told stories about my father introducing me to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And since I was living in a home in which my parents always felt a need to shelter me from the gruesome parts of movies, he would shuffle me out of the room every time a violent scene would come on and call me back in when it's done. So I saw a pre-edited version of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly when I was really young. And I guess I always kind of liked movies in varying degrees over the years. And like many people, I feel I shifted from it being a social kind of whatever thing I would do to something I kind of just dived deeply into and just enjoyed on a different level at some point.
Well, see, that's then the kind of the key to the question is, I feel like a lot of people, I feel like most people always have movies around them, and they grow into them with their families, you know, if not their parents and their older siblings, or maybe some friends. But I also feel like it's a question I ask of 3-time guests on my podcast, and I can't remember if I've asked it to you yet. But the question of when your love for film turned a corner. So even though I know, like, I probably could have guessed that it was your dad, but at some point or another, film probably went from something they showed you and something they watched to something that you would seek out, and you know, more than football, more than music. And I guess that's my question, is what, like, when did you come to film in that respect?
I think if I had to try and pin it down to one specific moment, it would have to be, and I don't even remember the year, it would have to be with a film that we're not actually talking about. It would have to be with The Bourne Identity. Because, and it's not anything to do with that film specifically. It had to do with my decision to watch that movie. Because I was still in high school at the time, and I guess it was just a thing with me and friends and going to movies, that every once in a while there would be a movie that, even something as typical as the Bourne Identity that you would assume a lot of people would want to go and watch, I couldn't really find anyone to go and watch it with me. And I created this rule for myself at that time in my life where I said, no matter what, no matter who doesn't want to go to the movie with me or whatnot, every vacation I had, I wanted my last day of vacation for me to go to the movies. And that was the first one, when I actually went to go and watch The Bourne Identity. I went and I watched it by myself, and I loved that movie.
Nice. Okay. It's funny. I can relate to that, because one of the turning points for me in going to movies was as an adult deciding I don't need my friends to come with me. Like there was a night where I really wanted to see Three Kings. I think it was opening night, and I wanted to see it on that night, that movie, and I couldn't seem to get a friend to come with me. They either didn't want to go outright or they would be okay going, but they didn't want to see Three Kings. And I think I went through like five different friends and nobody wanted to do it. And I said, like, screw this. I'm just going by myself. and it was that kind of thing. So just before we get one last question before we get into today's movie, because today's movie, one of the words that comes to mind to describe it is that it's very, very talky. And it got me thinking of what I know of you. And one of the things, of course, that I think of you is you as a podcaster. And I guess that's my last question is, what was it about film or just in general that made you want to turn on your microphone and talk about it and put it out there to the world? How did you get into podcasting?
How I got into podcasting, it was a really weird and simple decision that involved getting my friend to say yes. I've written about this actually on my site, and for anyone who hasn't read it, I started podcasting January 2009. Previous to that, the summer of 2008, I was doing my best to schedule and work out a way such that I was able to produce a television show. Let's call it, for lack of thinking I'm any good at what I do, let's call it the Ebert and Roper version of it today for me to do with my friend. It would have been me and Damien, my co-host of the Unnamed Movie Podcast, doing that show. And we actually shot a pilot that summer because a friend of a friend had this idea of opening up a new station locally here in Jamaica. And someone told them I like movies and had a site, and they were like, sure, come and do this. And we got camera crews and everything. It was actually shot and filmed. I do not have a copy. I wish I did, so I could share it with the world and show how awkward and weird me and Damien were trying to do this thing for the very first time. It was an entire day of production, and I had never done anything with television or film or just recording in any sense prior to this. And like, I spent around 3 months haggling with editors trying to get that pilot fixed. And I realized somewhere along that line that this was never going to happen. It was never going to see the light of day. This station was never going to be a thing. It was never going to show to the world anywhere. And I decided at that point in time, looking at my friend, I'm like, I want us to do a podcast. And I think it was primarily because I was getting into film podcasts a lot at that time. One of my favorite podcasts at that time, I used to listen to the Slash Filmcast. I used to actually try to be home. It felt like, because they used to do it live, I used to try to be home in time for the live cast to go up so that I would sit down and listen to them live and be in the chat talking with them. And it was such a thing. Even when we started the Unnamed Movie Podcast, we streamed it live on Ustream, and it was a thing that we enjoyed doing. And it's just something that we haven't yet got so annoyed with each other that we've decided to stop it.
This is gonna seem like the strangest question in the world, but it's playing on that and playing on what I know of you. And when I say what I know of you, I'm lucky enough to have like spent like face to face time with you. And I apologize because it's kind of like a dumb question, but do you like to talk?
I like to talk, but at the same time, over my years, I've learned the importance of listening. I'm someone who, if I feel like if I don't feel confident enough to contribute to the conversation, I will not talk as best as I can. But if I feel like I'm in a conversation where I feel I can contribute like sensibly, or if it's just me giving a joke, I will do it. But I'm very much the small room talker. I'm not the big room talker. I mean, I've had a couple stints here and there with public speaking, and I guess I'm okay with that, mainly because the world has asked me to focus on me. But previous to that, I don't think I would. If you got me in a room of 20 people, like even at pub night when I'm there, sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to sit down and listen to what craziness these guys think.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's great balance. Now, of course, I bring all that up because we are talking about a movie that is very, very, very dialogue heavy. And was not what I anticipated you choosing. And I'm not sure if that says something more about.
Were there not enough doves for my movie? Is that what you're saying?
No, there were not nearly enough doves. So we're talking about Reservoir Dogs, and how did you arrive at Reservoir Dogs in the first place? I would imagine there's no way you saw this in a theater.
Oh, hell's no. I would have been 6 years old at the time.
Good God, I'm old.
And I even question as to whether it would have been in my local theater in the first place.
Really?
I don't know. I don't think so. It doesn't seem like the kind of movie that they could have sold.
Okay.
But I got to this movie in a very weird way. And in all of my movie watching at the time, because I think I saw this movie somewhere around 2002 to 2003.
Okay.
I was into movies. I was watching movies. I was loving movies. I had started already building my DVD collection. I had things like Spider-Man and such in my collection because that's the movies you have in your DVD collection as a teenager. And on all of these DVDs, as all of them generally have, you'll see all of these trailers for movies in front of them when you pop them in. And I saw a trailer for Kill Bill on one of those DVDs, and something about it struck me, and I went, I should look up this movie and see what it's about to find out the world of Tarantino. And somehow Reservoir Dogs ended up being the first movie I found and watched from him. I think I even remember a friend bringing that movie to me, like a bootleg copy for me to watch, which is how I saw it for the very first time. And it just kind of got me. Somewhere in that time range, I didn't quite understand that movies could have rhythm like this movie had. And it works.
See, okay, this is going to be an interesting conversation because even though I forget that there is at all an age gap between us, moments like this reinforce it. Because No, I didn't, but I was there when this dropped. This would have been like right around this. I would have been 14 when this came out. So this was in the background when I was going to high school, and high school was when I really got into film. From the time I was like 14 to 19, that was really, really when my love of film took off. And Reservoir Dogs followed 2 years later by Pulp Fiction, and Tarantino was the thing. Of course, there were all the other movies that he wrote in and amongst there, and I'm thinking about stuff like Natural Born Killers and True Romance and those kinds of movies. But those two, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, he upset the apple cart. So I can remember a lot of what was discussed at the time, and that is what has actually shaped my take on Reservoir Dogs versus you coming into it 10 years later when it was very, very firmly established. And I would imagine it might have even played very differently because a lot of the beats that set it apart and seemed so, you know, for lack of a better word, revolutionary at the time must have almost seemed commonplace by the time you got to it 10 years later.
I honestly can't even remember those kinds of things because as I said, I liked movies, but I wasn't really fully immersed in like attempting to figure out canon or anything like that, to know what movies did, what they're doing now, what they want to accomplish. I was just enjoying movies one to the next. And the thing about this movie as to how it played with me, and I think I kind of mentioned it talking about rhythm, was that when you sit down and you watch action movies, you know those action movies already understand that they need to keep your attention every 10 minutes. They need to have another sequence happening to keep you just in that seat, not pressing fast forward or anything. With a movie like this, which is, as you introduced it, being very talky and obviously actionless, a movie which is a heist movie, which doesn't ever actually have a heist for us to enjoy. What touched me about this movie was the fact that it felt like we were moving through a story as if it was an action movie, but all it was a theater dialogue, basically, throughout the movie. And it was just weird to me. Like, it was just so oddly placed.
Well, it's patient is what it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, even today, I rewatched the movie for, I think, the first time in, like, a couple of years, which is odd for me with this movie, to be honest. And I always remember that opening scene, which is them at the breakfast table, and Tarantino giving his patented monologue of
like a virgin,
like a virgin. And I remember watching that and thinking to myself at a point in time, I wish these were the conversations I had with my friends, because there's so many things about pop culture and movies and even music that when you have that thought, I've had my issues with socializing, talking about my feelings in the real world, in the Caribbean as such, about these things, that I always feel like the buck stops at a certain level, but my brain went a 20,000 times past it, which is where Tarantino was going, which is somehow I figured out this song, and I didn't just figure it out. I want to share what I figured out with you, and I want to do it in such a way that I feel like I'm telling you my own story, and I'm holding you for 5 minutes. He could have so easily just come in and said, like a virgin's about a girl who got banged good. Right? And we figured it out in like 2 seconds, but the way he decides to write it out and play it out, it feels like he's telling the equivalent of a stand-up joke, where he's just stringing you along, and then when you get to that eventual end point, it just feels like complete entertainment from in every section of it.
Well, and then, like, the crazy thing is then that turns into the whole long discussion about tipping.
Right.
Right? But, okay, see, again, it kind of interests me that you say that you don't speak that way, because when I rewatched this movie, I rewatched it last night for a few reasons. One, because I hadn't seen it in a few years. Two, because of all of Tarantino's canon, it's actually his film that I'm the least familiar with.
Oh.
Even though I own it, figure that out. But as I was watching it, and as I was listening to these long conversations that are in no hurry to get anywhere, I was actually reminiscent of your show. Because this is a word that's going to come up a lot over the course of this podcast. There's a lot of bullshitting in this movie.
Yes, it is.
And even though every once in a while you actually do put your hand on the tiller, there is a lot of bullshitting on your show.
And which is what makes it work.
Because Lord, I cannot do what you do. It's a lot of things. It's the way the three of you get along. It's the way you talk about film. It's what you bring it up. There's a lot of just joyous bullshitting going on that to hear you say, you know, I hear the way these guys talk and I wish I can do it. Meanwhile, I'm sitting over here saying, that's exactly what you do. What the hell are you talking about?
Well, what I really mean is, first of all, you have to understand, when this movie came to me, it was at a time where actually it was around the time that I just started becoming friends with Damien. And I never really had those conversations about film with him or anyone
you thought about that now.
No, not even. Well, a little bit now, but I guess having
more so
my
at
podcast,
the time.
It's alleviated a lot of that desire that I had at the time. But I still have that sometimes, because what you hear me and Damien and Douglas do on our podcast, where we have these conversations and we have that camaraderie and that just timing that we can do that bullshitting and enjoy ourselves, I don't have that with other people. And even though movies and pop culture and music and all those things are things that everyone talks about with one another, and I know you know this too, even though it's not in the same tone, there's a way you will talk about it with certain people and a way you won't talk about it with other people, because you already know that they are not willing to go with you there in that conversation. And instead of disappointing yourself every time you attempt to do that, you just say, I'm going to let it just stay there and not bother to do it.
Now, one of the things that the other things I was thinking about when I rewatched it is, and this is again one of those things I'm going to come back with of what I heard at the time when I was young and you were six,
Are you feeling this conversation is inappropriate now that we are not age appropriate to
do this? No, it's fine. I had a bad joke in my head, but it's fine. It's fine. One of the accusations at the time, and something I can certainly see more of now because now he's one of my boys, is the accusation that this film rips off Scorsese. And Quentin Tarantino, for his whole career, has been painted as a ripoff artist, a guy who can write amazing dialogue, but as far as what he puts up on the screen is taking bits and pieces of all these movies that he saw as a video store clerk, and he's Frankensteining them together into a greatest hits package based on some awesome dialogue. And, you know, it's not – in this movie, it's not helped by the fact that one of his main guys is Harvey Keitel at all. But what do you make of that, that Reservoir Dogs is a kind of slimmed down, talked up version of a Scorsese film?
I actually don't really see it that much because I can see the crime correlation, because a lot of, even though I don't want to put Scorsese into any box because he is someone who does a lot of different things very well. It's very understandable at that time in the 90s to think of Scorsese as a crime filmmaker, right? And you can kind of think of it that way, trying to create these cool crime characters. And Tarantino is a ripoff artist. And I even remember last year for the first time I watched City on Fire, which is a not so famous Asian film, which apparently he ripped off this movie from. The last 30 minutes of City on Fire is basically the entire Reservoir Dogs. And it's a good, fun movie, but it's not as what Tarantino creates here. But to talk about Tarantino-Scorsese correlations, it's something where, like any correlation or any ripoff that Tarantino is accused or even admits to doing in his movies, because this man does it a lot, but I kind of feel it's the equivalent of someone making a new mix of a song where, yes, he admits to it and he's willing to shell out the fact that he took from something else. But every once in a while, those guys make mixes that are amazing and we're so happy they do it anyways.
Hmm. See, I feel that way about him now. Like now that he's, what is he now? Six films into his career? Like six features? Five features?
He is.
Kill Bill was four.
If you call Kill Bill as one, it would be six, I believe.
Okay, so let's be generous and call it seven. Like now that he's seven in, I see him more for what he's doing on his own. But at the time, when this was his first offering, and it was everything
he's at
from.
Eight. He's eight, at eight. Eight. Is if he you really? Call Kill Bill as two.
Oh wow! Holy shit! Time flies. at the time, it was, you know, everything from the longer shots to the suits, to the patience of the scenes and everything like that. It felt, to the way he would appropriate rock and pop music to his soundtracks. Cause that was really Scorsese's thing. Like he was really, really the first one to use rock music as a soundtrack, for a film. That's kind of his thing. That was the accusation at the time. Now, the crazy thing about this movie is, speaking of music, it's like a lot of films, it's known for one scene. And and it's, you know, even if you talk to a person who's never seen Reservoir Dogs, odds are they've heard about this scene and they've certainly heard this song. When you first came to the scene of Mr. Blonde playing Stuck in the Middle with You and doing his weird little dance with the cop, did that just blow your, like, pardon the pun, did that blow your brain?
It pretty much did. That song, as with all Tarantino fans, I imagine, is cemented in my mind, and I almost feel sad for people who knew that song before this movie existed.
Okay.
And had an affinity for it. I don't even remember the name of the band who
Steelers
did that.
Steelers Wheel.
Steelers, because I honestly, some of this music, I only know it from this movie, so I will know that one song, and I haven't yet had the impetus to go and dive into Steeler's wheel cannon.
There's no... Sorry, I'm laughing here because there's really no such thing.
Right, so my brain imagines it as that. It imagines that these guys had the one song, or even this song wasn't even that loved to begin with. And because Tarantino put it in the scene, it's become something so much bigger. I almost kind of put it akin to in Kill Bill, he had the O-O-O's, I think their name is. Or no, the song was it was 5, 6, 7, 8. We only know that one song, right? They have a few songs. They had an album. I remember that song started coming in ads on TV only because of Kill Bill.
Yep.
And it was this thing where he popularizes this song and we start to associate these songs not with the artists or with any sort of canon of music, but with that scene or that movie. And I've always had that with movies, that even other movies, Scorsese is another big one, Wes Anderson's another big one, where I begin to associate songs with movies more than I associate them with musical artists or albums or anything, because that's where I discover them for the first time most times.
The crazy thing, though, is that now, like, that's it's one thing to say that, and you know, going one other, like, you could be here for days citing examples of great musical moments in Quentin Tarantino films. You could do a whole other show based on that. But where Stuck in the Middle sticks out in relation to this scene is the way it reappropriates the song, this happy, bouncy, one-hit wonder of a song, and overlays it onto something gruesome, where you will never think of it the same way again. Like, that song starts playing, and you're thinking of Michael Madsen dancing around, and you're thinking of that cop getting bloodied up, and him, like, flicking the ear. The only other example I can think of off the top of my head is, and it's on a far lesser plane because it wasn't as famous a movie, is in the recent Dragon Tattoo, the David Fincher version, they play Enya during when Daniel Craig is getting tortured at the end. They play an old Enya song called Orinoco Flow, which when I was younger, you know, and you were two, you couldn't turn on a radio without hearing the stupid song. It was the dumbest hit on the radio ever. And it was like everywhere on top 40 radio.
Now that you bring it up, I want someone to give the same treatment to the Titanic Celine Dion song.
Yes. Yeah. There is one more example that comes to mind. And that's in, again, using a Daniel Craig example, in Layer Cake, there's a Duran Duran song that comes down when somebody's taking a beating. It's always when somebody's taking a beating. It's always when you play a song that doesn't suit a violent situation and overlay it onto a violent situation.
Well, I mean, you have the same thing with Kubrick and in Clockwork Orange with Singing in the Rain, right? Yeah. And that was even a bigger deal because it was live singing by Malcolm McDowell, and it wasn't just some soundtrack moment where you could feel like the director is taking a joke out of it. It's the actor doing it to the movie, and it feels weird. But to be quite honest, when it comes to this movie and even the scene, I remember, like, after I've seen this and when I started to begin to share this movie with friends and with people who'd come over and be like, let's watch a movie. And I'm like, have you ever seen this? And they would all hang on that scene and think of it as the most violent, gruesome scene they've ever seen in movies. And I couldn't understand it because I never thought of it as a violent moment, because while in theory, talking about the action itself is a violent and a horrible thing to be done to anybody, it's something you don't see, and it's something that doesn't really bother me. I wonder if that comes from me seeing Freddy Krueger when I was 3 years old.
Maybe.
It was just something that I actually got more into the music as just being a happy song, and it might have just warped my brain and made me think of happy things. I start to laugh at Michael Madsen dancing rather than thinking about him cutting off the guy's ear.
Well, how are you with violence in film? Because that was another thing that was discussed heavily when this was released. You had this and Pulp Fiction back to back, and with Natural Born Killers in between them. Just of Tarantino seemingly obsessed with violence. And I've never really asked you, like, is it, do you get queasy? Do you just take it? Is there anything in particular that you can't handle, or what's your relationship with violence in film?
Violence doesn't bother me at all in film. And I think it's mainly because at a very early age, I had decided, or at least let's say I figured out that movies were fake. Right. Mm. And I never quite get queasy at violent scenes. I've watched The Raid like 30 times. I put that stuff on a loop and I just go amazing at the kung fu that we get to watch. I don't look at the broken bones, and it's something that never really troubled me. Where I get into some questions are when they kind of become emotional with it. And I think one most recent movie that got me a little queasy and questioning was Fruitvale Station from last year, where it's not necessarily the violence that occurs in that movie, it's the way the filmmaker makes you invest in a character such that we kind of start to believe in his reality. We start to understand him. Like with action movies like The Raid or something else, we don't really get that emotional connection as closely as we do with some other movies. And when the final kicker in Fruitvale Station comes down, it feels that much more because you are connected with reality as opposed to understanding this movie as being something fake that is created for your entertainment.
So what you're saying is if Mr. Orange had have helped a dog and helped some white girl buy fish, then you might have been more shaken up.
Look, when you are willing to call your grandmother on a whim and put her on the phone with this random white girl, I feel for you, right? I feel for you.
Okay. So it's crazy because I'm better now. I've actually realized that I'm much better now.
Well, I had a much younger horror lifestyle than you, I'd assume.
Well, there's that. Like I've said many, many times, up until very recently, I was a pussy. And even just where violence is concerned, I was not terrible, but there were some things that I couldn't watch. Like the one that comes to mind, I always had to turn my head, in American History X when the bandit gets curb stomped.
I'm kind of curious because I mentioned it. I grew up in a very restricted household as it came to movies. I didn't get to watch a lot of these violent things until I was much older.
Right.
What was your relation with when you started to watch these violent things? Like, were you restricted as a child?
Well, I would answer that, but I'm the host. So, was I restricted? I don't think I was actively restricted. You know, like once in a while, my parents might have thought, no, too violent. But, I wasn't ready for it. It was something that just, I came to very late. I was a big fraidy cat in terms of a lot of things, actually. So it might have just been that there was this quiet symbiosis between myself and my parents of the violent stuff just gets left out, which is weird because a lot of my first experiences with films were TV edits.
Yeah.
Where some of the violence remained, but not all of it.
I always enjoy watching TV or TV edits of movies like today and putting the moral questions of what they are willing to say is okay. And yeah. Say, do you really think that's okay? And just laugh at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, that whole scene leads up to one of the ultimate shocks of this movie, and which is Orange getting up out of that lake of blood and gunning down Mr. Blonde.
Yeah.
Did that blow your brain the first time you saw it? Like, did that just put your jaw on the floor and you say, wait, whoa, what the hell?
The act of killing Blonde didn't really do much for me. It was the actual reveal of Orange officially being a police officer at that point in time. And even that little trade off that he had with the uniform cop going, yeah, I know who you are. We met at a party like 6 months ago. You were probably really drunk. That to me, like when that reveal came and then we went into the orange chapter, like that was more of a thing than the moment that Michael Madsen died for me.
Well, see, because I think from my perspective, that's actually what makes this film special, is that in that one moment, it's already halfway into the film. It's almost exactly halfway into the film. The film stops, backs all the way up, and starts filling in the blanks. You know, by that point, you already know that these guys are on a heist. You know that the heist has gone badly and that one of them is a cop. And really, all they had to do was he just had to say, I'm a cop, and the rest of it could have played. But for them to stop there, go all the way back to how Orange got into this whole mess, that's real. Like, first of all, that was what made this movie stand out at the time, was because broken narrative really wasn't being as employed as it is now. To use broken narrative in 1992, it wasn't being used in the same respect that it was at one time. Like, I'm not saying that it never was, because films like Rashomon and Citizen Kane and all that, those are more the films that Scorsese, or that Tarantino, that Tarantino had ripped off. But it wasn't very, very common to use a broken narrative. So just that alone, but the fact to go all the way back to the beginning, that is one respect where I can see this film still seeming very, very special.
The Orange Chapter is something that actually was very special for me, and probably the thing that got me with this movie the most, because, and I know I'm pretty sure a lot of people focused on this one scene when they saw this movie for the very first time, and it's the commode story. And it's more of what I was talking about with the opening sequence, talking about Like a Virgin. It was storytelling that allowed you to focus on dialogue in such a way that it felt entertaining. It felt like stand-up comedy, where they knew how to weave it together such that they kept your attention. And also there was this moment in the story that where we start to see it's not just about him telling the story to Mr. White and Joe and Crazy Eddie and you seeing the reality of that story through the cuts, through the flashback where we actually see it realized and him actually walking to the commode. It's the moment where you see him start to tell the story and he's actually still in the commode and the camera is going around him. And it's this moment where, like, that is the moment that blew my brain about this movie, because we actually see on the screen the idea of someone's perspective in storytelling, right? Someone is telling us a story while also having their own perspective and admitting to it through this visual moment. And movies do this a lot, but I don't think they draw as much attention to themselves as they do in this movie. And it's like, I question people who don't enjoy that commode story.
Well, it's funny, because before I sat down to watch the movie, I went digging on your site to look for what you might have written about Reservoir Dogs. And strangely, in the years you've kept your site, you've actually written precious little. The one thing that comes up is that scene. So I knew that you dug it.
I think I did do one post about this movie when I was doing the favorite scenes posts.
Yep. And and that was what I came to. And it was funny because you say storytelling, I say bullshitting. Because again, it gets down to the heart of the opening of this movie. And as I said, that dynamic that you, Damien, and Douglas share, and what I've seen you fall into, you know, the two times now you've been here, of sitting around just shooting the shit. And that's exactly what this scene is all about, is that in order to get accepted into any kind of certainly male-dominated environment, whether it's a workplace or a team or anything like that, you have to be able to shoot the shit. You can't be the quiet guy content to listen. You have to be able to either tell a story or go with a story or something like that. And that is, you know, just as much about the cadence of how you tell it and what you're telling as it is just being able to bullshit along with it and never having somebody call bullshit on you. And the crazy thing about this scene, what I love about it, so first of all, you know, it's Mr. Orange completely fabricating a scene. He's given the beats of it, and then he has to learn all the rest himself and build it up himself. And his buddy tells him that. He says, you have to know the details. And you think about it in your head. When one of your friends is bullshitting with a story, the more detail they put into it, the more you're willing to go with it. You know, if somebody just tells you this one-off thing of, you know, I was at this bar last night and this chick did this, you're just gonna say, shut up. You know, like go away. You're making shit up now. But if they tell you the whole thing of how she was sitting and what she was wearing and what you were drinking, like you're more willing to go with it. But what makes the scene have a master stroke, have an absolute master stroke, is within the context of this scene, what saves Mr. Orange from being found out of supposedly carrying these drugs is that the cops themselves are bullshitting. I'm like, okay, you know what? Tarantino, you may rip a lot of people off, but I gotta give the man props for that, because that is some meta shit going on right there of bullshitting within bullshitting. That is some Inception shit right there.
Tarantino is one of those guys, and I do love that moment where like we have that moment where he loses his shit, where Mr. Orange loses his shit, and the camera is going around him, as I mentioned, and then it stops to remind us that there's a conversation going over there. And yeah, it's a great moment in this movie. It's a moment where I feel I'm happy to send that scene to someone and let them enjoy it as a scene, as opposed to saying, watch this 100-minute movie in case you're bored.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that would certainly bring him in. How did this film like inform and shape your taste? Because like when I think about your taste now, and our taste in film does evolve over time, I'm actually starting to associate you more, and this sounds strange for me to say, to the lover of the FP. I actually associate you more with more cerebral taste. So like I believe, if I'm remembering right, last year your favorite film was Like Someone in Love.
That was the year prior.
Okay.
I messed up my list because it was my first year at TIFF, and I said I saw that this year instead of thinking that's not getting released till 13.
Gotcha.
So I threw that in my 12 list. Last year was 12 Years a Slave, as the official number one.
But that's the thing. Like, I think of you as more heady films, and I'm wondering kind of how this fits in. With that, was this a leaping off point? Is this not a guilty pleasure, but this is an old favorite, or is this, where does this fit into the whole thing?
I think it kind of is a mix of everything of those kind of responses, because I mean, how can I explain the fact that 12 Years a Slave is my favorite movie from last year, but within my top 20, there still exist movies like This Is the End, and I also had Drug War in there, and I'm pretty sure I tried my best to push Pacific Rim somewhere in the middle, and there was Superman, right? So I'm always a mix of all of these things. I tend to tell people that everything rates on its own different scale, that there are movies like Someone in Love, which is something that's completely different, and it's something that I fall in love with in a different way that I will fall in love with Pacific Rim, and a different way I will fall in love with Reservoir Dogs. And it is a bit of a leaping off point, and I think it kind of is a thing with this podcast and with people I talk to about films, that it's something that it showed me something that I never thought was possible in movies before. And it's part of that talky nature where, as I said, it held your attention. It was stand-up comedy. It was entertainment in narrative. It was, as you put it, bullshitting, right? Where they could just get you into these details, and you stop to worry. You stop thinking, where's the gun shooty shooty movie that I like to watch? And it's something that's special about that. And it's also something else that I've kind of come to realize about my love of movies and my love of just media and entertainment, which is it's not just the movie in all of its calculated little pieces put together that makes something special, but my actual experience of it in that 1, 2, 3, 4 times I'll watch it, sometimes I even start to get into this quandary of deciding what was a better experience because I only saw a movie one time 10 years ago and I loved it versus the Reservoir Dogs, which I've seen 20 times over a span of 10 years or 15. And I really can't decide as to what makes one idea better than the other. It's just something that I have to go on a gut feeling to say, this is the best today. And it's just one of those kind of things. I adore every one of them, but sadly when it comes to listology, which I know you're a bit of a negative on that to a certain extent.
We'll call me a resistor.
A resistor. It's something where eventually you have to choose a winner and everyone else is deemed a loser for some reason. I kind of see them to a certain effect all as equals and say, these are all things that will make you feel better. Go and watch them.
Now, one of the last kind of points I have about this movie is the way that it's really, in some respects, style over substance. So we've already talked about the way that it rips off a lot of things that came before. And, that really, there's not a lot of plot to this movie. You could write to steal the old cliche, you could write the plot of this movie on a cocktail napkin. Does that matter?
No, it doesn't at all. Some people would kind of blink an eye at those kind of things, but I tend to ask the question when it comes to movies like this, movies where you kind of realize that 80% of the conversations are nothing conversations, where it doesn't really push the plot forward, it doesn't add any information, all it does is a moment of just being a conversation. I ask people, how often did you look at your watch, right? And this is the kind of movie which gets away with the fact that even though if we took a brilliant scissors editor to this movie and just took plot alone, we could probably cut this down to a 25-minute movie.
Yeah, make it short out of this very easy.
But the amount of times I'm sure people, especially people seeing this movie for the very first time, look at their watch while they're watching this movie, I'm sure if once is many during this film watch. The movie it's about spending time with these characters, and I think that's kind of highlighted through the chapters that we get throughout the movie of each of these characters.
Hold on. I call bullshit here. Hold on. Because here's the problem. So we have Mr. Blue, Mr. Brown, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink, Mr. White. We don't know, aside from Mr. Orange, we don't know shit all about any of them. So we're not really spending time with them so much as we are spending time with these guys in black suits who aren't really revealing much to each other. We're not getting a whole lot of backstory here. When we're spending time with them, we're spending time with them while they've got the shields up.
Well, when I say spending time, I don't necessarily mean that they are giving us, yeah, I don't necessarily mean that it's quality time where they're telling us their tale and they're making us feel that, oh, they had a horrible childhood or whatnot. I kind of put it akin to one of my favorite moments from a film last year, The Great Beauty, where one of the characters is complaining about the world, that people aren't sincere enough or they aren't doing enough good in the world, and she's tired of the young doing. And he just responds to all these complaints saying, look, we're all old people who are getting older, and all we want in our lives is to just spend time with one another and not so much tell each other sob stories, but just be happy and spend time with one another. So would you prefer that or to be angry all the while? So my question to you is, do you prefer to think about a movie in which we followed Mr. Orange from Police Academy to the end of this movie, where we find everything about him? Or do we prefer that moment where Harvey Keitel is telling the joke about the waitress gluing the guy's dick to his belly?
Well, again, you're asking the host questions, and that's really not supposed to be allowed. But I will amuse you, considering it's your own show. The answer is I don't know, because it's the same as asking what the effect is, even though I have seen it, what the effect is if you put Memento in chronological order, or more apropos to the subject at hand, how Pulp Fiction plays if you play the scenes in order. The fact that we get it in the order we get it is really what makes it work. So even if we rearranged it and we started out by following Mr. Orange and then filled in Mr. White and filled in Mr. Blonde and filled in Mr. White, it would play different. Better? I don't know. What I do know is that I've seen that movie. I've seen the movie. And I think you just watched it. Like, I've seen Serpico.
Yes, I've seen Serpico. I quite love Serpico.
Yeah. Oh, no. Serpico is great. Even though nobody gets my joke when I start yelling Attica when somebody mentions Serpico.
Why does no one get that?
There's two problems. One, people just think I'm being dumb and getting the wrong movie. Two, 10 years has not been kind to Garden State. So there it is. I wonder if Quentin Tarantino leans too hard on gimmick with this movie in terms of what actually happens and how little these guys know about each other, because as I said, we get nothing. We get nothing, period. We get them all for maybe a moment or two before they start, but we don't know who's rich, who's poor, who has any attachments, if any. It's you know what it is? It's the short version. It's the ADD version of Heat is what it is. And I guess that's the thing for me. If you're asking me, then yes, I much prefer Heat. I much prefer to spend 3 hours with cops and crooks and their husbands and their wives than I do 90 minutes with Mr. Black, Mr. Pink, Mr. Orange, Mr. White.
So next time we talk about Serpico, I'm supposed to shout that she has Attica. A big ass at you, right?
Yes. And I will laugh heartily, I promise you. it's amazing, though, because when I had no idea what you were going to hand me in terms of what film you wanted to talk about, mostly because I tend to know people's favorites, but for some reason I'd kind of forgotten yours. You spend enough time talking with other film lovers and you get an idea of their tastes. You know, I know, for instance, I know Bob Turnbull is the Eternal Sunshine guy. I know that there's half a dozen movies that I associate with Kurt Halfyard. Being married to a film lover, there's four or five movies that I associate with her. And of all the movies that I associate with you, I didn't know that you would go with Reservoir Dogs, first of all. But then the moment you did, as I said, considering that it's a movie about people sitting around bullshitting, and what I know of your show, it actually seems like I think it might have influenced you more than you realize.
That is quite possible. Because I honestly, even though I've never been that guy to look up scripts and read scripts, I always imagine when we talk about script writing that I just imagine it as what I saw in the film written down on page, as opposed, and I know that's not really it, but that's what I imagine it of when I ever have that discussion and we use the word script and writing. I always imagine my scripts written in a Tarantino voice, and I can never do it, which is why I've never finished a script.
Well, there we go. I got nothing else.
Oh, wow. So I just want to thank you, Ryan, for doing this for me.
I'm supposed to be thanking you. You're the guest. So thank you for coming on the Movies You Love podcast.
Oh, I've been here so long. It feels like I'm trapped.
It feels like a year, I'll bet, right?
It feels like a year. It's been a year. It feels weird. And that was the show. I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank Ryan again for coming on and talking with me and doing something he's never done before, which is guest hosting. I think he did a great job. So go and read his stuff, listen to his podcast. He's over at thematinee.ca once again. As usual, as it relates to this show, you can go and hear it over on iTunes, over on Stitcher, over at my site at gmanreviews.com, and you can always find me on Twitter. I'm at gmanreviews. Feel free to go into iTunes. Actually, I shouldn't even say feel free. I'm imploring you. Go over into iTunes. Go give the show. Go subscribe to the show. Go rate it. Go review it. Go let me know what you think about it. Leave a comment in the post. tweet at me. Say nice or bad things. I prefer nice things, but if you say a bad thing, I won't hurt you. We'll start a discussion and see where it's going. But anyways, that's it for a year. We'll see what happens in the next 2 weeks with this podcast and see who comes on and talks about what. So thank you so much for listening and have a good night.